This Two Lectures episode features organic baker and author Andrew Whitley, recorded live at the Global Event in Cardigan, West Wales in 2008.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. It's a privilege and a pleasure to be able to come to speak at the Do Lectures. The reason I was invited, I think, is because David and Claire from Howie's came on one of my courses last year, and it grew out of that experience, grew one or two thoughts about what real bread is and what we might do to bring real bread back into the community and into literally all our hands. 650 years ago in France, just as in England, there was a movement of the peasants. That English word is an unfortunate one because it doesn't have any of the sense of the French word, paysan, which means people of the land. And it's used rather dismissively, and has been for many generations, I suspect, in this country, to denigrate the work that's done by the people who grow the food that we all depend on. This movement against the oppression of the feudal landlords, which became very intense towards the end of the 14th century, was secretive. It had to be, because otherwise people would have been arrested and further oppressed for organizing with their fellow countrymen. And in order to facilitate communication between the activists, they used a code word, a password, and that was, or a phrase, it was le pain se lève, the bread is rising. I want to take that as my theme today because I believe, literally and metaphorically, that the bread is rising. And I'm going to tell you why I think the modern bread system, as it's developed in this country and in many, many others, is unsustainable. And then I'm going to say a few words about what I think we can do about it. Not necessarily to make that system more sustainable, but to evolve a way of making bread which produces vitality, health, and satisfaction in those who make it. So, why is the modern bread-making system unsustainable? Well, literally, like almost everything else we do these days, it's unsustainable for the very obvious reason that it's completely dependent on petroleum, on the high use of energy. It's evolved because petroleum was there relatively cheaply. So the distance between the farmer who grows the wheat or the rye and the miller who mills it into flour and the baker who bakes it into bread has been blasted apart by petroleum. It's now many, many hundreds of miles usually, maybe even thousands, between the source of the wheat and the miller and the baker, because between each of those functions is interposed distance and profit. So we have centralized mills, usually located on the seaboard, to reflect the fact that we imported a lot of our wheat and have done for the last 250 years or so from distant lands. And we have distance between the mills and the bakeries, and between the bakeries and the central distribution depots of the supermarkets, between the supermarkets and the customers who have to travel there to buy the bread. So clearly, in an age when petroleum is becoming more expensive and eventually less accessible completely, that system either has to adapt itself to the use of less energy or it won't survive. But I have a further complaint about it, in fact quite a few, which I'm going to enumerate now, and that is to do with the quality of what is produced by it and the way in which it's produced. Among other things, the system causes alienation throughout its progress. It alienates mainly the people who work in it. And it's no accident that there is now a skills shortage in the bakery industry of major proportions. The big bakers regularly wring their hands and say, we can't get skilled people to do the work that we want them to do. And there is a demand for relaxing immigration rules to allow more East European bakers who have a very good training and can actually make bread. But the problem is that the big bakers have systematically de-skilled the job, expecting people to stand by machines doing one operation, rather than participating in a whole process from start to finish making good bread. So they deserve the skills shortage that they've currently got in many ways. But I don't want to say too much more about that until the end, about what we might do about making bread ourselves or in small communities. For me, the main problem is that the product itself has, through a series of small steps, become very different from what it was and what it could be again in future, and what, in my opinion, it should be. I'm going to have to rush through this a little bit because I want to leave time for questions at the end. But I'm going to break it down into three sections. One is the nature of the wheat that, and I'll concentrate mainly on wheat, although it, of course, applies to other things like rye and, to some extent, barley and oats as well. But wheat is our primary bread-making cereal, and that's what I'm going to talk about. So the wheat that we grow is one section. The next is the way we mill it. And the third is how we turn that flour into bread. And each of those parts of the food chain, of the bread chain, has changed quite significantly over the last 100 years or so. Milling began its change a little bit more than 100 years ago, but the other main changes have taken place really since the Second World War. And when I say change, I mean that by a series of little steps, really, each of which seemed quite rational at the time, which were, in a sense, intended to produce laudable aims like an increase in yield or productivity or a reduction in cost to keep the price down to ordinary consumers. But each of those has been won at, with the assistance, of course, of high energy input, but also at the cost of certain steps which we now know have fundamentally altered the vitality and the digestibility of the product that we know as bread. So far from being the staff of life, it is, in fact, something that many people pretty much systematically avoid eating. And it is strange to me that an industry which is presiding over a long-term decline in the sales of its product should be so resistant to a message which points out to them why it is that people don't like it, because it gives them tummy ache or it makes them even iller than that. So what have we done to the wheat? Well, if you're a farmer in this country, you have access to a list of cereal varieties, which is presided over by the Homegrown Cereals Authority, and it lists the recommended varieties for milling and baking for human consumption, and also those for animal feed, for feeding to pigs and chickens and so on. And this list is divided up into quality criteria, so you can read the name of a wheat, Paragon, for instance, and you can then see its yield against the average. You can see its straw length being very important, because in highly intensive chemical systems, which involve a lot of soluble nitrogen, long-strawed varieties of wheat tend to fall over. There's too much vegetative growth, and they can't stand up to the wind and the rain. So the breeders have progressively reduced the height of the straw so that they stand up better. And, of course, there are chemical straw stiffeners that are sprayed on as well, just for good measure. Now, the next column would deal with something like natural resistance to pests and diseases, because, of course, as soon as you kind of up the ante in terms of productivity of the grain, make it produce more, if you like, then those grains are more likely to be prey to incursions from pests and diseases. So you want to breed in as much natural resistance as you can, and where that fails, you have a plethora of fungicides and insecticides to give you the backup that you need. And then there are things like the quality from the point of view of milling. Is it suitable for bread making or for biscuits or for cakes and that kind of thing? So you can choose the variety if you're milling for a particular, growing for a particular miller who wants top quality bread making flour to put into his grist, then you would choose a variety which performed well according to those criteria. And then there's a sort of line, and below that you have a series of varieties which are suitable for animal feed production. And guess what? You have all the same criteria, but there's a new column appears there. It's called nutrition. And it says whether or not these things are rich in certain micronutrients and how they perform in terms of digestibility for the pigs and the chickens and the cattle that are going to be fed them. But that column is absent when it comes to human beings. And so it's hardly surprising that in selecting wheats progressively, generation after generation, with quite aggressive and cutting-edge plant breeding techniques, we have evolved wheats which actually perform very well in terms of the criteria that have been set, but they just have forgotten about the final purpose of the bread, which is actually to nourish people. At least that's my take on it. I don't know if you agree. Sometimes I wonder when I read the publicity, the sort of internal publicity of the baking industry, whether they actually really think about the final consumer in any other sense than they're a person who takes a square-looking object off a shelf, at that point, their interest seems to subside somewhat. And the notion that bread is something which one might actually recommend people to eat less of in the expectation that less would be better for them is a notion so hateful to them that they try to dismiss the sort of message that people like me are bringing as the ravings of left-wing loonies and such like. But when you get that sort of reaction from people, you usually know that you're onto more or less the right thing, so I persevere. Now, we've got wheats which have been bred for intensive systems, which are, in a sense, progressively less nutritious. And by way of evidence for this, I want to quote you just one study. You may think that this is a shameless commercial opportunity that I've given myself here to promote my book, but actually there is a serious reason that if anybody is interested in checking or following up any of the claims or contentions that I'm making here, then the evidence is actually referenced in the back of the book. So I'm not just sort of throwing these things out. But there was a study done in France which very simple. It took organic and non-organic grains grown in the same place at the same time, same area, I mean, and it milled them. There were, I think, three varieties, tested them as grain and then as flour. And it milled them in two different ways. One was through stones, the traditional method of stone milling, and the other way was through roller mills. And roller milling is a more complete method of separation of the grain into its constituent parts, which was brought in at about 1870 and has become ever more sophisticated, so that the miller can prise apart the wheat grain and do extraordinarily clever things with all the fractions. Extraordinarily clever usually means leaving most of the non-nutritious white bit for the human beings and feeding the rest to the animals, or selling them to the pharmaceutical industry for the vitamin E and that kind of thing, but you get the general idea. Technologically very clever, they do it because they can, and they don't think what the end result is, which generally speaking is nutritional impoverishment. Okay, some gets put back in and some whole meals are reconstituted out of this flour, but in general, roller milling produces a more damaged product than the traditional stone milling, which simply grinds the flour up all into one and produces a whiter flour simply by sieving out some of the coarser bran particles, leaving in quite a lot of goodies. Now, this study showed that the roller milled non-organic wheat was 46% less rich in magnesium and 50% less rich in zinc than the organically grown stone ground wheat. Now, those two micronutrients were chosen, they did analyze one or two others, I think iron and calcium were also involved, but I chose to highlight those because they were very significant differences between a method of agriculture and a method of milling feeding through into the quality of the food. And of course those two micronutrients are now, as we know from fairly recent study, very important to human nutrition. In fact, they appear in the government's guidelines, certainly zinc does, and I think magnesium does, for sort of minimum levels for children's nutrition, and many doctors are aware of the importance of them in getting better and healing. And indeed, most groups in the population, according to government figures, are deficient in magnesium at least, if not zinc. So these are important things which we are losing from our wheat, or have lost, by the way that we grow it and the way that we mill it. If we come on to the way in which we make it into bread, then here perhaps the biggest change that took place was the invention of the now infamous Chorley Wood bread process. What did they do? Well, with absolutely noble and honourable intentions, the scientists there set out to try and increase the quantity of homegrown, UK-grown wheats in the national bread supply, because up until the Second World War, and indeed in the period immediately afterwards, we struggled seriously to get enough grain coming in, particularly when U-boats were sinking all the ships coming across the Atlantic, to make our bread. And we were dependent on the high-protein wheats that came from Canada, the United States, Australia, and so on. And this technological challenge which was set to them, in cahoots with the plant breeders, was to up the quality of British grain so that it would make a loaf of bread. The problem was that the method chosen was to try and emulate a particular style of bread, or to reproduce it, using a higher proportion of English wheat, and that bread was the familiar sliced white bread made in a tin. which was the favourite of most people in this country, and to some extent still is, although its popularity is declining. And in order to make this possible technically, the Chorley Wood bread process did two key things, perhaps three really. It reduced the amount of fermentation time to zero. There is a concept in baking called a no-time dough, which means that you don't allow it to rise at all except for that small period of time that it's in the tin, when you can't help leaving it to rise, otherwise you get a rather shrunken loaf. And the guys with stopwatches and clipboards can't do anything about that one, except to ask the bakers to put larger quantities of yeast in, which they have done, in order to make it rise even quicker, to get the whole thing through as fast as possible. But the other thing that they did, key thing they did, was to use certain additives to condition the dough to make the gluten, that stretchy stuff that makes the bread rise better and hold more gas, more stretchy, more resilient, so that it would actually stand upright and, as one wag put it, make water stand upright more effectively. Because that was another thing, adding lots of water in the dough, it being cheaper than flour to sell to the public. All this was made possible by an intense use of energy, so that dough is mixed a ton at a time or more in very high-speed mixers under vacuum sometimes for 3 minutes. And the energy input is phenomenal, and that reflects the whole sort of energy footprint of the baking industry, which, including the transport involved, is quite significant, and of course a major problem now in terms of cost of power. Now, what is wrong about the additives? Well, had I been giving this talk 15 years ago, I'd have been telling you about and perhaps complaining or criticizing the use of chemical additives like potassium bromate or azodicarbonamide and various other strange-sounding things, which were used as oxidants and emulsifiers and so on in the dough to make it improve, to improve it, as they say, and to make it stand upright better. And I can't do that anymore because those have been, after several decades of regulatory approval, have been withdrawn as being carcinogenic. Such is the fate of regulatory approval by scientific committees. Because, of course, they tend to look at toxicological models of safety, feed a lot of stuff to a rat in a laboratory. If it doesn't keel over fairly quickly, it's passed as safe for human consumption. I'm caricaturing slightly, but there is no, generally speaking, no attempt to look at either the long-term effect of additives or their cocktail effect in association not just with other additives that there may be in the product, but also with the other foods that people may be eating. And this is an important issue because the generation of additives that replaced the chemical ones that were banned towards the end of the 1980s, were enzyme-based. And these have certain very interesting effects. From the baker's point of view, they have one massive advantage, and that is you don't have to tell the people that you're putting them in. They aren't declared on the label. So you all, if you go and eat 95% of the bread that's made in this country, is probably uses enzyme-based improvers now. So if you go and eat an ordinary loaf of bread from a shop or a bun from a burger joint or whatever, it's almost certainly been made with the use of not just one, but several enzymes. Now, these enzymes we'll just leave aside because we haven't got time to talk about it, the issue that several of them may well have been genetically modified. But it's more important to understand that nobody really knows what the effect of those is in conjunction. We know that they have the ability to make the bread rise better and to stay soft for longer, quite prodigiously longer now. Traditionally, a loaf of bread would last for 3 or 4 days before it began to get a little bit harder, and that was when we used it for toast or for croutons or crumbles or stuffings or various other uses that our culinary tradition had developed over many years. But now, bread stays soft and squidgy pretty much until the mold overtakes it and it decomposes. I've done a test with this, actually. I used to carry with me to events like this a loaf of, I suppose I might as well say the brand name, Kingsmill Crusts Away, it's called, the loaf baked for kids, because kids are supposed to not like their crusts, or parents are too frightened of their children to tell them to eat them, or something. And this loaf was designed not to challenge their tender little gums, and so the crusts had been cut off. And a friend of mine sent me one of these loaves in order to as a joke, really, and saying, this is what you're up against. And I brought it out and sort of held it in front of people, saying, you know, this is the problem. And I squeezed it together like this, and it expanded again like a concertina. And that was sort of a couple of weeks after it had been baked. And then it hung around in my box of, you know, books and papers and things. And the next talk I gave, I brought it out again and said, oh, by the way, this is still in the same state as it was a week ago. And this went on for several weeks in the autumn of 2006. And in fact, nearly 3 months after its baking date, it was still doing exactly the same thing. Now, it did eventually go moldy, but that was because, to my great embarrassment, with the autumn, I live in the country, and the autumn ingress of small furry things from the garden, one of them got into the kitchen and found this box of stuff on the floor, hopped in, but curiously enough, only ate the packet. It had eaten rather more of the packet than of the contents, which was probably a wise choice from the point of view of its digestion. But that allowed air into the packet, and eventually it began to go mouldy at that end. And I obviously couldn't carry around a mouldy loaf of bread to show people. And so as I threw it away, I just tested the bit at the end which wasn't mouldy, and it was just that same sort of soft texture that it was after it came out of the oven. Now, that may be just a wonderful technological achievement, delivering fresh bread to people pretty much in perpetuity, and that's the way it's marketed. But you have to think, what is that doing to our insides? Because, as we all know, when we have a jippy tummy, when we've been slightly ill and are just recovering, haven't eaten anything for a couple of days, you know, that sort of thing you occasionally get, what do you want when you're just beginning to start taking solid food again? My hunch is you probably want, you know, something dry, a rusk or a biscuit or maybe a little bit of dry toast, certainly not with any fat on it, certainly not anything squidgy or fresh or succulent like a freshly baked loaf of bread. That's my experience anyway. And the reason is that the starches in a freshly baked loaf of bread are, as they say, cross-linked, and the proteins as well. There is a sort of joining together of the molecules so that they are more, it takes them longer to break down. And that's the state, that sort of joined together, gluey state that the enzymes actually force them to stay in for several weeks or months. And that means that every mouthful of that stuff poses a bigger challenge for your stomach, digestive enzymes, to actually break down. Now, it so happens that one of the enzymes which is commonly used in the food industry, and particularly in that section of the food industry that likes to make its living by agglomerating small pieces of protein, you know, the sort of turkey twizzler kind of thing, or mechanically recovered meat, sort of squidging rather unseemly stuff into some sort of shape and selling it as something suitable for children. That's the kind of thing. They often use a cross-linking enzyme called transglutaminase from a synthetic source. It's also a biological agent in the human gut, actually, in another form. But this transglutaminase has been shown in combination with wheat protein to actually turn the wheat protein into the most problematic form for people with wheat intolerance and celiacs and people like that who can't tolerate gluten at all. So this is what I mean about the cocktail or the unpredictable effect of using this kind of food additive. And most of our bread is now made like that. So the use of additives, and particularly hidden ones, which nobody is given the choice of adopting or rejecting, is one key aspect of modern bread, which I think needs to be revealed and stopped, if at all possible. But I want to just say a little bit about the role of time in fermentation, which I alluded to before, because the no-time dough, or the short fermentation of Chorley Wood bread, and virtually all the bread that is made commercially on large industrial systems today, we now know from research that's been done only in the last 5 or 6 years, really, we now know has various pretty negative effects on the quality of the bread. For one thing, the process of fermentation allows the action of certain beneficial bacteria in the wheat dough and rye dough. These are called lactic acid bacteria, or lactobacilli, and they are really the most remarkable organisms. It's not surprising that a lot of research is being done to them now. Most of it, I have to say, is financed by an industry that wants to get active compounds out of it, sort of what lactobacilli can we use to generate nutritional supplements or other sort of food conditioners that we can put into processed food, a side of food which I don't think need concern us very much here. But lactobacilli in their natural form, in as they work in a long fermented bread or what we'd call sourdough or a leaven, which is just simply a flour and water mixture which is allowed to spontaneously ferment for hours or days, those lactobacilli can do remarkable things. They can increase the amount of certain important nutrients that are available to the human body. Just to take one topical example, folate or folic acid, which we are being threatened with mandatory fortification of all our flour with folic acid in order to stop a fairly small number of spina bifida births in young women whose folate status is low because they eat an inappropriate diet. The issue is that if you ferment bread for 6 hours instead of 0 hours or half an hour or something, in other words, increase the fermentation period, not sort of excessively, but within the bounds of what used to be quite common in bakeries, you double the amount of folate that is available to the person eating the bread. So that's one very simple remedy that could immediately transform, you know, if everybody practiced it, the amount of folate that people were getting from their bread in this country. Oh no, we have to choose the fortification, the chemistry set approach, because to do the other would be to challenge bakers to look at their systems and to argue the case for a more wholesome and restrained and less time and profit orientated system. And of course that would offend against the great god of competitiveness, which we all worship. So the lactobacilli can do that. They can also create substances, or rather guard against substances which are naturally present in the flour, like phytic acid, which locks up certain minerals, or acrylamide, which is a carcinogen which can form in the crusts of certain breads when they're baked hard or toasted. So these things can be reduced just by the presence of the products of a long fermentation. And then they have certain sort of accidental or incidental other benefits which are highly apposite and relevant, like, for instance, the fact that breads made with a long fermentation in the presence of lactobacilli can always have a lower glycemic index, which means that they get into the bloodstream more slowly when you eat them as bread, and therefore they have a higher satisfaction quotient. And this is an important factor in the context of a society which has been described as obesogenic, in other words, tending to encourage us all to overeat and to become fat. And it really isn't good enough, in my opinion, for the food industry to say that there is no such thing as an unhealthy food, there's only an unhealthy diet. Because if the foods themselves have been so nutritionally hollowed out, as I've tried to indicate that we have done with our bread, that it means that people need to eat three slices when previously they would have got all they needed from two, then that is what I call an obesogenic diet or atmosphere, because your body is saying, hang on, I've had two, I ought to be satisfied, but curiously I'm not, therefore I will eat another. And it's something that goes on, of course, at an out-of-awareness place in our consciousness. So the role of fermentation is one that has been grossly underestimated. We now know that it is important that time takes place somewhere in the baking process, and there is an urgent need to revise our entire bread-making method to put that time back in. We will find, if we do that, that the quality of the bread that results from it, if the research that's been done to date, and I readily admit that very much more is needed, is to be believed, we will find that the nutritional quality of the bread and the nutrient density, as they tend to call it nowadays, of the bread will amply justify the extra cost involved if you only quantify the cost in terms of the extra time it takes. And really, the time argument in terms of industrial production is one that I'm sure is not beyond the wit of production managers and technologists to overcome. So there is a solution, I think. But actually, my main contention is that this bread that we've now succeeded in creating, this wonderfully efficient, low-cost, ubiquitous, tasty, soft forever, in some cases fortified, wonderfully varied product that we now have in our supermarkets, is actually probably something that we should systematically avoid in order to improve our health. And I'm going to suggest one or two ways in which we can do something about that. My contention is that what we really need to do is, to put it into sort of a catchphrase, if you like, is to bring bread back to life. And by that I mean at several levels, to bring it back to life in terms of the process, because the life has been sort of squeezed out of it in terms of the hidden life of the yeasts and the lactobacilli, which come to life during that extended period of fermentation and do all kinds of very good things for us. And so we want to bring that element of life back into bread. But we also want to bring it back to life in the sense that we want to make bread serve life in two important senses: the life of each individual who consumes it, rather than being problematic for their digestion or nutritionally so denuded that they need to eat too much of it or whatever, but also back to our lives as social human beings, because bread has been grossly commodified. It is very rarely now the subject of home manufacture or community celebration. It is something that we go into the supermarket, we know the value of very largely, and occasionally it's the subject of vicious price promotions which bring it down to well below the price of a postage stamp. And in certain of the price wars that occurred in the 1990s, it was possible to see pig farmers going in with supermarket trolleys and buying large quantities of industrial bread because it was cheaper for them to do that than to buy ordinary feed for their pigs. So that degree of insensitivity or denigration of one of our national staple foods seems to me to speak volumes about the way we see ourselves and our food culture, and I want to suggest that an alternative is possible. So I'm suggesting that we can, by stages, progressively, not all at once, but according to our lights and interests, we can opt out of the bread system. We can make it ourselves. It's easy. Those of you who are coming tomorrow, I hope we'll find out just how easy it is. And by easy, I don't mean easy in the sense of just sort of putting it into a bread-making machine, pressing a button easy, but actually easy to do it properly, because it's even easier than that, because you don't even have to switch the mixer on. If you do it with your hands, that is. But I don't necessarily mean that everybody has to make their own bread. I know Satish Kumar believes exactly that, and what a wonderful possibility that might be. But I'm thinking more of informing ourselves as to how easy it is to make it by hand, and then to support those people who are trying to do it in a way which prefigures the relocalized, closer connected world of the future that beckons to us now, so that we might expect, for instance, to think of our bread not as something that we go and get from a supermarket necessarily, but something that connects us with the farmer who grew the wheat, who may be visible in our locality or not far away, and the miller who ground it into flour, and that those might be connected with a neighborhood bakery of some sort, either our own domestic one or a community one, or a commercial one working in a small scale, connecting up those various aspects of the food system in a chain which is human scale and not so dependent on petroleum. I think that we might be able to do some of this by joining or participating in a thing that I'm helping to start at the moment called the Real Bread Campaign, to take some of its inspiration from CAMRA, from the Real Ale campaign of the 1970s, which is still growing strong, and has the great advantage that it's open to everybody, not just the over 18s. So I hope that it should engage the interest and imagination of lots of people, young and old, because what we need to do with this campaign is to increase education and awareness about what constitutes real bread. Some of the things that I've said to you tonight, some of you will have been familiar with them. Perhaps others weren't aware that you've been eating stuff that's not declared on the label, for instance, or that the indigestibility that you sometimes suspect may be down to the bread you've eaten is actually programmed into it by a series of steps that begin in the soil and the plant breeding effort and the milling and the baking and so on. And we can unpick that and put it back together again in a healthy way, but we need people to understand why that might be a good thing to do. And I think that we can do that in a spirit of joyful celebration and sharing, which actually gets to the heart of what bread is about. I'm not a particularly religious person, but I am struck by the metaphorical power of some of the key stories in the Bible, which often revolve around bread. And one of the ones for me which has most resonance is the story of after the crucifixion and Christ's rising from the dead, walking along the road to Emmaus and striking up a conversation with two of the disciples, and them not recognizing him until they sat down at table and broke bread. And that moment of breaking and sharing bread was the moment at which they recognized the person for who he really was. It seems to me that there's a lot in the familial and nourishing and nurturing environment of bread making and sharing which would repair some of the damage that our atomized, individualistic and greedy society has done so much to encourage. So I would like to see people sharing. I'd like also to appeal to the activist mentality, which I suspect is in the audience to some extent anyway. I have one or two ideas for fast-tracking an awareness in the public of the hidden ingredients in bread. It's called the Stick One On Them campaign. It's very simple, really. We know that there are additives in bread, enzyme additives and other compounds of a similar kind, which get under the radar because the law says they don't have to be labelled, but they are used in bread manufacture. So let's go out there with the information printed on little blocks of small post-it notes. And every time we go into the supermarket, we can peel off a few and stick them onto the relevant loaves of bread, just as a completely free public service to inform the public as to what is really in the bread. Now, of course, we would combine that with an appeal to resellers of bread, supermarkets and so on, to come clean about what actually is in the bread and the possible effects of eating that sort of stuff. I see no reason why that should be contentious or illegal. But no doubt somebody might object to it. But it would be part of an awareness-raising campaign which would, I think, gain some publicity and also satisfy the desire for instant action that some people have. On a more serious note, there are, according to one estimate by an insurance company, about 7.5 million, probably more by now because this was about three years ago, this statistic, 7.5 million bread-making machines sitting in English kitchens and cupboards, not all of them being used regularly. And it would be nice to think that we could generate a national bread-maker campaign where everyone was encouraged to get them out and use them. The reason would be, obviously, to make their own bread and to get that sense of empowerment and control over the ingredients that go in them, because you don't put any enzymes or, you know, other stuff into your own bread. You put flour, water, yeast and salt. You don't even need the milk powder that all the recipes for the bread makers tell you to put in there. So you can have control over it, and you might actually begin, as many people have, to take an interest in the process and then to take it further and to do it more regularly with or without the bread maker. But one of the key things that would be really interesting about that would be to tie it up with carbon footprint campaigning, because it's almost certain that making a loaf of bread, if you take it from the flour bag stage to the table where it's consumed, making a loaf of bread in your kitchen in a bread maker has a much lower carbon footprint than going to the supermarket and buying one. They use very little energy, actually. They're quite compact and well insulated. And the distance of travel, of course, is only a matter of feet. So if we could show that the number of sort of tons of CO2 that would be saved by everybody making their bread in a bread maker, we could have a make your own bread in your bread maker, save the world kind of campaign, which I think would excite certain people's imagination and also raise the issue about the energy dependency of the current bread system, which is, of course, its Achilles heel, apart from the fact that it screws up our guts. Now, there is somebody who is planning a campaign, an element of a campaign, which I think is the most marvelous thing. It's one of the people from one of the larger sort of medium-sized commercial millers, Shipton Mill, who does a lot of organic grain. And John Lister is the owner of that concern. He's got an idea for making a sourdough or a leaven, a natural fermentation of bread dough, starting at Land's End and walking to John O'Groats, but stopping every day and making bread with that leaven and sharing it with whoever comes to wherever they're going to make the bread. And it could be, you know, one man and a dog, or it could be a group of people. The idea being that they then take a bit of the leaven and they take it back to their homes, their communities, and maybe some of them will do little legs themselves, walking for a day or two further down from the sort of central spine of England into communities, sharing this one leaven, which will then infect the country in a kind of fungal network. And I think that's the most wonderful way of educating people in the simplicity of bread making, and also its connectedness. And we could have a website which showed the kind of progress of this, like one of those sort of animations, you know, seeping out into all the distant parts of the country, bringing not only good bread that people make with each other, but a sense of community and of togetherness, which bread really is all about. And on the back of that, I propose an idea which I'm working on, and I'm sure other people are at the moment. You're familiar, I'm sure, with community-supported agriculture, the notion that people can have a different relationship with the people who grow the food, collaborating to help grow it or help finance it in advance, and share in some of the tasks when they're needed, rather than simply going buying the product from a third party. I see no reason why one shouldn't have community-supported baking. Under current economics, it's quite difficult for small bakers doing real bread to compete with the low-cost, sort of subsidised-by-the-planet kind of baking that our industrial bakers do. So in order to support them and make it possible for them to survive and prosper until they're really needed and the other guys go out of business, I propose community-supported baking, where people come together in a whole variety of different formats, if you like, from helping the baker on a kind of once a week basis to, as in one shop in Suffolk I'm working with, the community owned and run shop, setting up from its 44 or so volunteers a little roster of people who do the bread every day. And it's not that difficult. It can be done in a way which makes bread for the people who come to the shop and maybe at one or two passers-by. But what it does, apart from producing a source of good bread at affordable prices, is that it spreads knowledge, this very basic knowledge of how to turn flour and water into good food, back into the community where it belongs. And that, I would humbly submit, if there are any industrial bakers here, might be a better place to look to solve your skills shortage than in the training systems of Poland or Hungary, good as they are, and good as the bread that they produce there is. So, in conclusion, I would just say that although I'm not necessarily over-optimistic about the future as a whole, I am hopeful. And I'm hopeful because there is a definite sense, I think, in our society of something needing to be done about bread, no pun intended. There is that sort of ripple of interest and involvement which just is waiting to well up and transform itself actually into a final product, just in the way that good bread does, given time and attention and a little bit of humility. Ladies and gentlemen, le pain se lève. Thank you very much.
The Do Lectures is here to share stories of remarkable people in the hope they will inspire you to go and do amazing things too. There are over 300 talks to listen to, or if you prefer, watch on our website, thedolectures.com. Hit the subscribe button on your favourite podcast platform to get the latest episodes when they come out.